Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm while she's away on vacation. This spring, history was made when three female astronauts aboard Discovery met up with a fourth woman on the International Space Station. It was the largest ever gathering of women in space. It was 27 years ago that Sally Ride made history as the first American woman to travel in space. But today, she's on a different mission, which might be as challenging as spaceflight. She wants to dramatically raise the number of women who pursue careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. Sally Ride joins me in the studio to talk about her efforts to encourage girls and women to reach for the stars. Delighted to have you with us, Sally Ride. Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good morning.
You can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850 or email us at drshow@wamu.org. And we're particularly interested to hear from women and girls out there who can talk to Sally about this issue of how do she and so many others concerned about this generate interest in science and math. So we want to have a good conversation on that. And call us and share your experiences and your thoughts with Sally. But I want to start, as I mentioned, 27 years ago, you made that space flight. You were an astronaut for a long time. You were a PhD. You became an academic for a number of years in San Diego. And then you left to start this company, Sally Ride Science. Tell us about where your motivation came from, why you decided to spend this phase of your life on this particular issue.
Well, it's actually pretty easy to explain. While I was an astronaut, I spent a lot of time talking to young girls, young women, and women around the country, just as part of my job as an astronaut, going out and communicating with the public.
The public relations side of the job. Yeah.
Exactly. And then when I went to become a professor at University of California, San Diego, I spent a lot of time, of course, in the classroom talking with undergraduates, women undergraduates, and I discovered that there weren't nearly as many women in my physics classes that I was teaching as I expected there to be by then. There were not that many more than when I was an undergraduate, you know, many, many years before.
At Stanford, if I'm not mistaken.
At Stanford. And I realized that there were a lot of young girls, elementary school, middle school, who are very, very interested in science. I heard them when I was out speaking to groups of girls. But by the time they got to college, they weren't taking the physics courses in the numbers that I was expecting them to, and that many people did. So I started doing some research and discovered that it was reasonably well known that long about upper elementary school, 5th, 6th, 7th grade, we start to lose both boys and girls, but more girls than boys from interest in science and math. And with some friends, I started kicking around the idea of starting Sally Ride Science as a way of reaching those girls in particular, boys and girls, but we've got a particular focus on girls that we know are out there, that we know in elementary school have an interest in science, but that we start to lose in upper elementary and middle school. We started with the motivation that you know, science is fun. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I'm a scientist, and I'm a scientist because I really enjoyed it. I was fascinated by it, and we wanted to extend that opportunity to, you know, just thousands and thousands and thousands of other girls in the country. So we started the company believing that that was the best way for us to reach large numbers of students, particularly girls in that age group.
Now, go back to your own history. Growing up at a time, as you point out, when there were relatively few young women in science classes, what fired your imagination? What led you to the career that you had, even at a time when it was not very common for women?
It wasn't common for women when I was growing up, but I was very fortunate. I grew up in the early days of the space program, mm-hmm. And, you know, back in those days, the early space launches were on the front page of the newspaper all the time. It was the cool thing going on. The entire country was focused on, you know, the race to the moon and our attempts to get people into space for the first time and do a successive set of new and different things. So, you know, when I was in upper elementary school, going into middle school, every kid thought that was the coolest thing around. Every student, the boys and the girls, were fascinated by
but
it.
But there were no girls in the astronaut program, so it took a leap of imagination for you to see yourself as one of that all-male group.
It did, and it was really fascinating. I don't think that I always dreamed of getting a chance to do that. I don't think I consciously thought of it as a career choice, you know, when I was 11, 12 years old. But I knew from the time that the teachers wheeled those big old black and white TV sets into the classroom to let us watch some of the early splashdowns or launches, that was something that I would love to do someday. It was true of a lot of the other girls in my class, too, but as time went on, something happened to them that diverted them from their interests in science and math, and that just didn't happen to me. I was probably fortunate that my parents, though not scientists, thought that if I liked science, that was good enough for them, and that they would encourage me in whatever I wanted to do. And I had some teachers that took some time and spent some time with me. And I never ran into that one person who said to a lot of my friends, you know, science isn't for girls. There's no job for you in physics. Don't go that route. And I just barreled forward.
I've read the story that while you had these childhood dreams watching that black and white TV, that you actually saw an ad in the newspaper for the astronaut program.
It's true. It was actually quite a bit later in my education. I was a physics major at Stanford University and graduated from Stanford with a degree in physics, and then went on to graduate school at Stanford in physics, and was just about finished with my PhD. I was just a couple of months away from finishing my PhD when I was sitting in the Stanford student cafeteria one Tuesday morning, about 8 in the morning, reading the Stanford student newspaper, the Stanford Daily. And I literally still remember to this day opening up the Stanford Daily and seeing in the lower right-hand corner of page 3 of the Daily an ad that NASA had put into the Stanford student newspaper and student newspapers all around the country saying they were looking for applications for astronaut and, more important, they wanted women and minorities to apply. You know, NASA was smart enough to know that unless they put the announcement out broadly to student newspapers, corporate newsletters, that the women who were qualified to apply would never even hear about the opportunity, and it would just be the usual suspects, white military test pilots
right.
that applied.
Who were the John Glenn syndrome.
Exactly.
But it had to take, and by the way, I'm talking to Sally Ride, first woman astronaut in space, and we have some lines open, 1-800-433-8850. Give us a call and talk to Sally. Yes, you grew up, no one told you couldn't do it. But again, the template, the cultural template was John Glenn. It was the white male test pilot. It had to take some act of imagination for you to see yourself in one of those suits, to see yourself in one of those rockets. Because at the time, there were no role models.
There were no role models. And I think that, you know, role models are just really important. One of my heroes growing up was Neil Armstrong. Other role models that I had growing up were my science teachers who were female. You know, so I think that it helped me to have teachers who were female, who were scientists, encouraging me along those lines. But it probably, I don't know whether it was a leap of faith and a leap of imagination or whether it was just not really paying attention and not really thinking that maybe I shouldn't be pursuing that.
I should make clear, of course, while Sally Ride was the first American woman in space, there were two Russians who preceded you. Do you know those women? Have you ever met them?
I actually have. Valentina Tereshkova was the first woman to go into space back in 1963. And then 20 years later, Svetlana Savitskaya, who I have met, who's just a wonderful person, had a chance to be the second Russian and the second woman to go into space.
Now, the ad said women and minorities, but still, there must have been plenty of times when, as a woman, you ran into a lot of obstacles in making your way to that point where you were finally launched into space.
There were, there were obstacles. There were NASA had cleared all the overt obstacles out of the way. So what were left were more
cultural.
They were stereotypes. They were people's attitudes. They were, the people at NASA were largely male. In fact, at the time that I started in the astronaut corps, along with our astronaut class, there were about 4,000 scientists and engineers at the Johnson Space Center, 4,000 technical employees at the Johnson Space Center, and less than 5 were women. And
my
so
goodness.
That gives you the idea of the culture that was there. It was a very, very male culture. But NASA had spent about 2 years convincing most of those scientists and engineers that this was happening. And, this was really a good thing. They might not think so initially, but it really was going to be a step forward for the program.
I want to talk to you about this program of role models, but it must be, I mean, Sally Ride, it's a brand name. As you go around the country, there must be a gratification that people recognize this model, that you yourself are part of this, the solution to the problem.
There's, I'm very gratified by that. I entered the space program just to get a chance to go into space. But, what I've realized is that it was a huge honor and an enormous responsibility, actually, to be the first woman.
I'll be back with Sally Ride and your calls, your comments in just a minute, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and my guest this hour is Sally Ride, well known to many of you as the first American woman to fly in space in 1983. But since then, she has made a career of trying to convince women and girls that the world of science, technology, math is for them as a career. You can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. And I want to get back to this question you raised earlier about there's been a lot of studies of this, and that girls are interested in science at about the same level as boys through about the fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Then by eighth grade, there's a real fall off. And this is part of the target audience your campaign is aimed at. What have you learned about why there is that fall off and what can be done about it?
It's really interesting. There is research that shows that in fourth grade, as many girls as boys are interested in science. And they'll tell you that. The statistics show that in fourth grade, if you ask, do you like science, 68% of fourth grade boys will tell you they like science, and 66% of fourth grade girls will tell you they like science. And that's been true for a couple of decades, so that's not something that's new. But starting in 5th, 6th, 7th grade, we start to lose both the boys and the girls, but we lose girls in greater numbers. And the reasons tend to be societal. They're not reasons of aptitude. They're not reasons of interest. You know, in 4th grade, they were just interested. So science has not gotten less
interesting.
Unlike
what a former president of Harvard implied.
Exactly. It is not aptitude, and there's a lot of research out there that shows that now. The societal messages that kids are bombarded by, they start to internalize at about 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. And it's everything from it may not be cool these days to be a scientist or an engineer. For a girl who's 11, if she says she wants to be an electrical engineer, there are no obstacles in her way. But she may get a very different reaction to that sentence than an 11-year-old boy who says exactly the same thing.
Get the reaction from who? Parents, teachers?
Could be her peer
classmates,
group.
Classmates. Yeah.
Could be her teachers. Could be her parents. And it's just, you know, that age, 11-year-olds are very smart, and they start to internalize these messages and think that, well, maybe I want to be doing something else. The messages that they get from society can be very, very subtle. I'll give you an example. At one of our Sally Ride Science festivals for girls, we had about 1,000 fifth through eighth grade girls on a college campus. And one of the proudest mothers in the world brought her daughter up to meet me to make sure that she told me that her daughter was just a brilliant math student. She had just won the school competition. She had actually just won the regional competition. She was about to go on to the state competition. And then her mother went on to say, and I don't know where she gets it because I was never any good in math, and I don't know any women who are. And the message that mother, proudest mother on earth, mm-hmm. is completely unconsciously sending to her daughter is that
she's a weirdo.
She's a weirdo. You're not normal. And, you know, at age 12, I mean, what is the most important thing in the world? It's to be normal. So it's that sort of subtle message, and it's also the stereotype of a scientist as, you know, some geeky looking guy that looks like Einstein, wears a lab coat and a pocket protector, and hasn't seen the light of day in ages. Yeah. And that's, you know, if you're an 11-year-old girl, that's not what you aspire to be when you grow up. So it's the sort of things like that start to sending girls off in different directions.
Well, there are some characters in popular culture. One of my favorites is Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus, which mm-hmm. is and their stories really have significant scientific component, and there not only is the sort of the chief explorer there a woman, but girls participate in those stories with equal fervor with the boys.
Yes.
And so there are some elements of popular culture that do this.
There absolutely are, and I think that what we need is more of them, more areas in popular culture where science is seen as cool, where girls and women are participating equally with boys and men. And we need to provide the girls growing up with concrete examples of living women who are doing cool things, women who used to look like them. You know, the 11-year-old African-American girl needs to see an African-American woman as an environmental engineer or as a microbiologist or whatever, so that young girl can put a human face on a career and see a path for herself into a career like that.
Now, you mentioned that doting parent who was very proud, but off track in terms of the message she was sending. We've got a lot of parents listening to us right now, including, I'm sure, many who have girl children or grandchildren, as I do, two young female grandchildren. What kind of advice would you give them? What kind of things? Are there certain books they can read, movies they can see, places they can bring their kids that would reinforce the very point you make?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that probably the the first thing is, you know, just be very aware of the signals that you're sending to your daughter or to your son, for that matter, because these messages can be very subtle, and they really do make an impact. The other thing is, you know, if you've got a daughter, a granddaughter, make sure that you've got the same expectations for her achievements in math and science as you would for your son or your grandson. You know, it's kind of old school now to think that math and science aren't important for girls. Well, they are. They're as important for girls as they are for boys, and that's been true now for quite some time. And then, of course, the other thing is that you can help them by speaking to their teachers and making sure their teachers hold these same high expectations mm-hmm. for their daughters. And you can take them to science centers, science events, and you can make sure that they see examples of female role models, you know, whether it's in materials, you know, books that you get for them, whether it's in posters that you buy for them, you know, or whether it's in, you know, some of your friends may be female scientists, female chemists, microbiologists, make sure that they know that. And I think that all of these things can help to counter some of those stereotypes that the kids start to develop at that age.
Now, you made the point, while your focus certainly appropriately enough is on girls and young women, that this is not just a problem of gender. It's not as if America is overflowing with male scientists. and Barack Obama just recently, in one of his comments, pointed out the appalling statistics of the United States education in science and math compared to other countries that were way down compared to a lot of other countries. Why should this matter? I mean, there's a national interest question here often doesn't get mentioned, but tell me your thoughts on that.
Well, it's exactly right. I mean, we need to improve the science education for both the boys and the girls, and we need to increase the number of boys and girls that are fully participating in science classes all the way through high school and on into college, whether they're going on to become rocket scientists and electrical engineers and microbiologists or not. And there are several reasons for it. One is that, you know, science and technology are really the engines that drive our economy. So our future competitiveness depends on being able to educate this generation and the next generation of innovators, engineers, explorers, scientists. More fundamentally, though, just basic living wage jobs increasingly rely on math and science skills. So, you know, fully 80% of the jobs in the future are going to require some kind of skills in math and science. So the kids in school today need those skills just to be able to compete for jobs. And then furthermore, it's become more and more important that we have a scientifically literate citizenry, because just pick up the newspaper, turn on the radio, the issues that are surrounding us are increasingly rooted in science and technology, and having some basic background that helps you kind of sift through and understand these things are more and more important just to be able to vote responsibly and make decisions that affect your life. So it's a very, very critical issue, and it's important for all of the students who are in school.
Let me read you some emails from some of our listeners. Carolyn from North Carolina writes, "I want to thank Sally, give her my appreciation for all she's doing. I'm a woman, very successful computer scientist. The science of the future is all about iterations, trying many things and learning from each one. I think girls and women need to be taught that failure, even public failure, can be okay, and have the confidence not to fear it. I love hearing Sally talk about the joy she finds in her science, because that's what we need to focus on." Your reaction to Carolyn?
Carolyn's absolutely right. I mean, you know, science is about asking questions and hypothesizing possible answers. And in order to test whether your hypothesis is right, you have to experiment. You have to, basically determine whether what you think is right is right. You have to do experiments, and collect data. And you're going to be wrong.
You're going to be willing to fail.
You're going to be wrong more often than you're right. far more often than you're right, probably. But each time you try something, each time you try an idea, you learn from that failure. You learn
That's
something.
That's the scientific method.
It is, it's part of the scientific process, and it's a very, very important part of learning and of science. So you really do have to be willing to pursue your ideas. And if you were wrong, you were wrong, but you've learned something, and the next time you may have a better approach.
Here's Catherine Hill writes to us. I am a researcher at the American Association of University Women, where we recently produced a report called Why So Few? Women in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. I'm sure you're familiar with the report.
I am.
One of the topics we explore is the importance of, quote, a growth mindset. That is, the belief that intelligence can grow with experience and learning. That is, people aren't innately gifted with math or scientific skill or knowledge. The growth mindset is especially important for girls who face the stereotype that boys are somehow, quote, innately better than girls at math and science. Did Sally have a growth mindset as a girl and a young woman? Did she ever feel that she wasn't good enough at math or science? And how did she overcome that feeling?
That's another great point. I did have a growth mindset when I was, when I was growing up. So it's all about appreciating that, great scientists aren't just born. They're curious. They ask questions. They try to understand the world around them. Science is hard, but you actually make enormous progress just by applying yourself, by studying, by thinking, by experimenting, by working. The same is true in math. People think you either innately understand how to solve a math problem or you don't, and that's just not right. There's a lot of learning to be done, a lot of practicing to be done, and that all contributes to the growth mindset. I did have that mindset. I worked hard to learn to learn the math that I learned. I worked hard to learn the science that I learned, just the way that I worked hard in other subjects.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and we can finally do away with the innate gender-based innate abilities.
Please, let's.
Lois writes to us, I am pleased to say that Sally Ride has been encouraging girls' interest in science for a long time. I'm a longtime Girl Scout leader. If I remember correctly, she addressed a Girl Scout science-focused event near Roanoke, Virginia in the late 1980s. Those girls are now about 30, but I suspect that if I asked them, they would still remember that event. They loved hearing from a real astronaut and learning about how science can be applied both to the daily life as well as to their career.
I really appreciate that, and I think that it's absolutely true that girls, young people, they do get inspired by hearing from from people who have achieved what they would like to achieve, and it's absolutely critical to them.
And here's Matt writes, I am in bioinformatics. I'm sure you know what that is. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm sure you do. Bioinformatics, and attended both biology classes and computer science classes in college. I noticed that my biology class was normally about 50% women, and yet perhaps only 20% women in my computer science classes. Why do you think that women are so much more interested in biology than computer science, physics, and math?
So it's very observant. He's got the percentages just about right. In college now, biology and chemistry are about 50-50 men and women. In computer science, physics, other areas of engineering, it's right around 20% women. And, people have come to accept that now women are good in biology, they like biology, and they think that that's always been the case. Interestingly, if you look back to the statistics of in 1970, which is not the dark ages, it's a while ago, but it's when I was in college, only 8% of medical school students were female, and people kind of assumed that women didn't really didn't like biology either. And I think that what has happened is that we've generated a critical mass of interest. The culture has changed for biology, chemistry, and some of the sciences, but there's still this ingrained stereotypes and culture around engineering and physics. And it's primarily because even back in 1970, the numbers were so much lower. They've had so much farther to go in those areas that we just haven't knocked down the stereotypes yet in those areas. So I actually think that those numbers will increase as well.
You know, I see as a college teacher teaches political science and journalism the flip side. I had a feature writing class last semester where 16 women and 4 men. So there's a push-pull there as well. Let me read you a note from Kimberly Walker, who's a PhD and teaches medical and research technology in Baltimore at University of Maryland. The only way to assist in keeping numbers up is to get parents involved, Dr. Walker writes. No matter how good the teacher is, if the parents don't think this is a suitable career for their child, for whatever reason, the student will do something else when we lose a potential scientist. Can you comment on the parental role?
Parental role is very important because parents, you like to think that teachers are critical, and of course teachers are. A good teacher can make all the difference to a student. A bad teacher can turn them away from that subject forever. But teachers don't see the students all day or in the evenings and in the mornings. Parents do. And parents, of course, have a lifelong influence, or at least a much longer influence than on their children than the teachers do. So it's really very important to tell the parents how important it is to really focus on their students, their
That's
children.
That's Sally Ride. I'm Steve Roberts sitting in for Diane today. We're going to be back with your phone calls. You stay right with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the classified military documents leaked by WikiLeaks. We talk with New York Times reporter Mark Mazzetti about the decision to publish those documents in the Times and what they reveal about the war in Afghanistan. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. My guest this hour, Sally Ride, first American woman in space, now devoted to Sally Ride Science, her company which promotes interest in science and math technology education for girls and young women. And Sally, a number of women in particular want to share their thoughts with you. And this one email comes from Marilyn Buchanan in San Antonio. I have dreamed of becoming an astronaut. since I could look up at the sky. Granted, this sounds like most kids' dream, but I'm in college now and still aiming for it. I'm going for a mechanical engineering degree and thinking about flight school, as well as thinking about going through the military to help me into space. I love science and math, but I was wondering if I was on the right track. You are one of my inspirations, and hearing a response would make me so very happy.
You're definitely on the right track, Marilyn. Mechanical engineering is a great major for going into the space program. Flight school is a good step. I would say that either the military or civilian.
Did you have flight training?
I did not have flight training before I went to NASA. NASA provides flight training for all the astronauts once they come, but I came from an academic background and had, in fact, never been in a private plane before I became an astronaut. So all that changed very, very quickly. But it's a good path, and NASA looks for people from a wide range of backgrounds and a wide range of college majors, and that's, you know, frankly, that's one of the things that we try to emphasize in our teacher training and the work that we do with students, is that there are many different exciting and viable career paths into a number of different science and engineering careers, including astronaut.
Now, here on that very subject, Sally, we've had several emails along the line of this one. It's great that efforts are being made to encourage children in science, but my concern lies with the career aspect. I earned an engineering degree in 1980, but have not been successful in maintaining employment while taking time out for raising children. In a technical field, it is very difficult to take years out or part-time for family and then re-enter the workforce. Work-family balance issues need to be an effort in order to make a science career a valid option.
You know, I think that that's a really important point. Work-family balance is something that's important in a whole variety of careers. It's very important in technical careers. You know, I do work with other companies that are not technical companies, and it's an important issue in those companies as well.
And as one of these issues here, Sally, as this caller indicates. I mean, we talked about incentives and disincentives up and down the line. We talked about parents. We talked about classrooms. Is there also a component here of employers, engineering companies or research companies that make it possible for women to have families and careers?
There absolutely is, and I think that because it may be this, I think, is an issue more for technical companies, as your listener pointed out, than in some other areas, is that those fields have tended to be predominantly male, and so there's been less focus on the importance of work-family balance. There's been less focus on childcare, as an example. There's been less focus on time off to raise family and re-entry into the workforce. Other sectors of the economy have dealt with that for longer and more successfully than the technical area. So there's definitely a component that says, okay, all these companies are the technical companies are now trying to hire women. They recognize the advantage of the diversity in the workforce, and they need to put in some time to understand what's required to retain and promote those women, because they'd like to retain the women.
So many women took seriously my admonition to write in, including a lot of women in science, and I'm really grateful for that. I'll read one more email, then we'll go to live callers, but I wanted to read this one from Denise Busen, who is a PhD in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Denise writes, "As a retired scientist, I'm interested in outreach activities that would keep girls in the science pipeline. Dr. Ride's opinion, which programs and activities are most effective at doing this?" I'm sure there are many folks listening to us who hear your message, would like to get involved. What's your answer to Denise's question?
Well, it's actually a good question, because there are a lot of good programs out there. I'll tell you about actually one that we're very excited about right now, and it's the Sally Ride Science Academy. We we're working on this in partnership with ExxonMobil, and Exxon has been an excellent partner in helping us reach, expand our reach, reach school districts around the country. Now, I have to admit that we have not yet reached Minnesota, but we're actually in the process of a teacher training academy now where we've got teachers from 19 different school districts around the country, including Dallas, Miami-Dade, D.C. Public Schools, several other states as well. I think we've got 9 states
represented. And is there openings for people like Denise to teach in those programs?
Actually, we're recruiting faculty to teach in those programs, in our teacher training programs. We've got faculty from around the country, faculty from Texas, Tennessee, Kansas, and it's absolutely critical to be able to scale some of these programs like ours so that they can reach not just one school district, not just 2 school districts, but many school districts and reach the teachers there. Let me just say that one thing that we frankly need more help with is finding scientists and retired scientists, retired engineers, or practicing scientists and engineers who can act as role models for the teachers, for the classrooms where these teachers are teaching, because nothing helps students put a familiar face on these careers better than having, a female electrical engineer, female mechanical engineer, female biochemist walk into a classroom and say, this is what I do, this is what I did, right. I love it, this is why I'm excited about it.
Now, someone like Denise, and I'm really grateful for your email, is there a website that someone like she can go to that would I'm sure there are other people listening who say, gee, I'd like to do that. I've got some extra time. I'm a retired scientist. Mm-hmm. Where can they go?
There are a couple of places. Our website is sallyridescience.com.
Okay.
A fairly easy one. There are other programs like a MentorNet program, which is a very good program that tries to connect scientists and engineers, particularly female scientists and engineers.
MentorNet. Good.
I think it's MentorNet.org.
Okay.
To students, female students who are interested in science and engineering, and I think all of these things are important. I'll mention one other program for the girls themselves, which we also partner with several companies. And it's Science Festivals for Girls, and we do these around the country. Again, we have not yet hit Minnesota, but we've hit several other states. And these are Sally Ride Science Festivals. We have several corporate partners. ExxonMobil happens to be a corporate partner on these as well, as does Northrop Grumman. These are open to all fifth through eighth grade girls.
Excellent.
In the local area.
Let's turn to several of our callers. Toby in Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Dr. Ride, my question concerns NASA as a career. Our older daughter was inspired by you and also by Roberta Bondar, as we are Canadians. She had a serious interest in becoming an astronaut through high school, but abandoned the interest because she said that there was too much politics involved in NASA. She went on to get a master's degree in biomedical engineering from Boston University after having done a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering at Princeton. She's now in a PhD program in biomedical engineering, and she's also an MD. So she has achieved science. But I'm distressed that NASA is as political as it is, and the fact that President Obama has dramatically changed the focus of NASA, and it makes me wonder if it is reasonable to pursue a career at NASA when so much is dependent upon political and economic realities.
Thank you very much, Toby. Please.
I think that that NASA is not nearly as political as you might think, and as your daughter might think. Although NASA, of course, depends on its budget, depends on the federal government for its budget, depends on Congress, the administration for its budget, and for many of its priorities. NASA itself, when you are working in a program at NASA, if you're a scientist or an engineer, you're pursuing science or engineering. You are really not affected by politics. NASA is very much a technical agency. Most of the employees within NASA are scientists and engineers.
What about the larger point that Toby makes about President Obama's policy changes relating to NASA? Just recently, a Senate bill removed money for the Return to the Move program.
Right. So NASA, first let's just set the stage. NASA has a large portion of its program is in human spaceflight, human exploration. An equally large portion of its program is in science. So the Hubble Space Telescope, exploring the Earth from space, understanding the Earth, trying to understand the universe, a lot of basic science. The part that has been affected is the human spaceflight program. And again, to just give a little bit of background on that, back in 2004-2005, NASA was set on a course to return to the moon. Sadly, that program was not well funded, and as a result, it got way behind schedule. And I was part of a panel that investigated that over the summer. We actually spent several months investigating that and determined that that program was not executable as it was envisioned, and that significant changes needed to be made and significant funds had to be put into the program if human exploration was going to go beyond low Earth orbit. So that kind of set the stage for President Obama's decisions.
I'm Steve Roberts. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I want to get in a couple of more callers here, and let's turn to Paula in Rehoboth, Delaware. Welcome. You're on The Diane Rehm Show, Paula.
Thank you. I have a question that will be more pertinent to your older listeners. I was in college in the mid-1960s and had made it to that point with a strong interest in science. But when I took my freshman science course, I opted for organic chemistry, loved it, got an A in it, and was consulting with the professor on what I should take next, and was informed that that really didn't make sense for me as a woman to pursue a career in chemistry. I should consider other options. And unfortunately, I listened to him, and I did end up in semi-science. I became a statistician, but with a double major in sociology, which I guess was more appropriate then. So my question is there anything, is it better now, or is there any effort being made to educate teachers and professors so that they don't do that to at least this generation?
Good question, Paula. Thank you.
You know, I mean, you're absolutely right. That happened to way too many women in the 1950s, the 1960s, and frankly, even into the 70s and early 80s. Yes, it has improved significantly, and there are far fewer of those professors who will say, you know, that's just not an appropriate career for a woman. There still are, though, some teachers who will give, some teachers, some counselors, maybe at college, but it's a little bit more prevalent at the middle school or high school level, who will subtly or not so subtly turn girls or young women towards different careers that they still see as somewhat more suitable for girls. That's actually one of the things. I mentioned the Sally Ride Science Academy that ExxonMobil's sponsoring, and it's on my mind because we're in the middle of one right now. That is one of the things that we're really trying to get across to the teachers and the counselors that attend, middle school teachers, middle school counselors, elementary school teachers and counselors, that these subtle signals are not appropriate anymore, that these fields are just as important for the girls as for the boys, and here are some ways that you can encourage the girls.
You have time for one more caller, and Sarah in Norman, Oklahoma, I know you wanted to talk about a similar subject. We don't have much time, but we're delighted to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. What I would like to say is I've graduated high school within the last decade, and I'm a stay-at-home mom now, housewife, and but when I was in high school, if you hadn't failed a subject, by the time you got to senior year, there weren't a lot of options as far as math and science classes available if you wanted to stay on the academic track, if you weren't in advanced courses or something like that. And so I think that's what I was more of a comment, you know, that I would like to make about the public education system and how.
Thank you, Sarah. We really appreciate it. Final word here, Sally Ride. We've had several other callers who are parents of daughters saying, what can I do? What's your final word of advice here, to not just to teachers, but to parents?
You know, I think the advice to parents is really pretty simple. Watch what you say, watch what signals you send, and try to look for opportunities to encourage your daughter, to introduce her to role models, whether it's introduce them in person or introduce them in print, in materials. There are materials that illustrate role models on our website. There are plenty of them in other areas as well. Take them to science centers, take them to museums, and talk to their teachers, and make sure that their teachers hold the same expectations that you do for your daughter.
Good note to end on. Dr. Sally Ride, first American woman in space, now head of Sally Ride Science. Also, I should add, the author of 5 science books aimed at young women. So delighted to have you with us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I'm Steve Roberts. I'm sitting in today for Diane, and delighted to have you spend an hour of your morning with us and with Sally Ride. Thanks a lot.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.